Green Hornet rolled onto its left side, moving faster and faster as the right engines thundered at full power. There was no time to radio a distress call. Phil looked for a swell over which to orient the plane for ditching, but it was no use. He couldn't haul the plane level, and even if he'd been able to, he was going much too fast. They were going to crash, very hard. Phil felt strangely devoid of fear. He watched the water rotating up at him and thought, "There's nothing more I can do." Louis sat down on the floor by the bulkhead facing forward. There were five men near him. Everyone looked stunned. No one said anything. Louis looked out the right waist window. All he saw was the cloudy sky turning around and around. He felt intensely alive. He recalled the bulkhead in front of him and thought of how his skull would strike it. Sensing the ocean coming up at the plane, he took a last glance at the twisting sky, then pulled the life raft in front of him and pushed his head into his chest. One terrible, tumbling second passed, then another. An instant before the plane struck the water, Louis's mind throbbed with a single final thought. Nobody's going to live through this. For Louis, there were only jagged, soundless sensations. His body catapulted forward, the plane breaking open, something wrapping itself around him, the cold slap of water, and then its weight over him. Green Hornet, its nose and left wing hitting first at high speed, stabbed into the ocean and blew apart. As the plane disintegrated around him, Louis felt himself being pulled deep underwater. Then, abruptly, the downward motion stopped and Louis was flung upward. The force of the plane's plunge had spent itself, and the fuselage, momentarily buoyed by the air trapped inside, leapt to the surface. Louis opened his mouth and gasped. The air hissed from the plane, and the water rushed up over Louis again. The plane slipped under and sank toward the ocean floor as if yanked downward. Louis tried to orient himself. The tail was no longer behind him, the wings no longer ahead. The men who'd been around him were gone. The impact had rammed him into the waist gun mount and wedged him under it, face down, with the raft below him. The gun mount pressed against his neck, and countless strands of something were coiled around his body, binding him to the gun mount and the raft. He felt them and thought, "Spaghetti." It was a snarl of wires, Green Hornet's nervous system. When the tail had broken off, the wires had snapped and whipped around him. He thrashed against them, but couldn't get free. He felt frantic to breathe, but couldn't. In the remains of the cockpit, Phil was fighting to get out. When the plane hit, he was thrown forward, his head striking something. A wave of water punched through the cockpit, and the plane carried him under. From the darkness, he knew that he was far below the surface, sinking deeper by the second. He apparently saw Cuppernell push his big body out of the plane. Phil found what he thought was the cockpit window frame, its glass missing. He put his foot on something hard and pushed himself through the opening and out of the cockpit. He swam toward the surface, the light coming up around him. He emerged in a puzzle of debris. His head was gushing blood and his ankle and one finger were broken. He found a floating hunk of wreckage, perhaps 4 feet square, and clung to it. It began to sink. There were two life rafts far away. No one was in them. Cuppernell was nowhere to be seen. Far below, Louis was still ensnared in the plane, writhing in the wires. He looked up and saw a body drifting passively. The plane coursed down and the world fled away above. Louis felt his ears pop and vaguely recollected that at the swimming pool at Redondo Beach, his ears would pop at 20 feet. Darkness enfolded him, and the water pressure bore in with greater and greater intensity. He struggled uselessly. He thought, hopeless. He felt a sudden, excruciating bolt of pain in his forehead. There was an oncoming stupor, a fading, as he tore at the wires and clenched his throat against the need to breathe. He had the soft realization that this was the last of everything. He passed out. He woke in total darkness. He thought, this is death. Then he felt the water still on him, the heavy dropping weight of the plane around him. Inexplicably, the wires were gone, as was the raft. He was floating inside the fuselage, which was bearing him toward the ocean floor, some 1,700 feet down. He could see nothing. His Mae West was uninflated, but its buoyancy was pulling him into the ceiling of the plane. The air was gone from his lungs, and he was now gulping reflexively, swallowing salt water. He tasted blood, gasoline, and oil. He was drowning. Louis flung out his arms, trying to find a way out. His right hand struck something, and his USC ring snagged on it. His hand was caught. He reached toward it with his left hand and felt a long, smooth length of metal. The sensation oriented him. He was at the open right waist window. He swam into the window, put his feet on the frame, and pushed off, wrenching his right hand free and cutting his finger. His back struck the top of the window, and the skin under his shirt scraped off. He kicked clear. The plane sank away. Louis fumbled for the cords of his May West, hoping that no one had poached the carbon dioxide canisters. Luck was with him. The chambers ballooned. He was suddenly light, the vest pulling him urgently upward in a stream of debris. He burst into dazzling daylight. He gasped in a breath and immediately vomited up the salt water and fuel he had swallowed. He had survived. Part 3. Chapter 12. Downed. The ocean was a jumble of bomber remains. The lifeblood of the plane, oil, hydraulic fluid, and some 1,000 gallons of fuel, slopped about on the surface. Curling among the bits of plane were threads of blood. Louis heard a voice. He turned toward it and saw Phil, a few dozen feet away, clinging to what looked like a fuel tank. With him was the tail gunner, Mac. Neither man had a May West on. Blood spouted in rhythmic arcs from Phil's head and washed in sheets down his face. His eyes lolled about in dazed bewilderment. Phil looked at the head bobbing across the debris field and registered that it was Louis. None of the other men had surfaced. Louis saw one of the life rafts bobbing in the water. It was possible that the raft had been thrown loose by the disintegrating plane, but it was much more likely that the engineer, in the last act of his life, had yanked the raft release handle just before the crash. The raft had inflated itself and was drifting away rapidly. Louis knew that he had to get Phil's bleeding stopped, but if he went to him, the raft would be lost and all of them would perish. He swam for the raft. His clothing and shoes weighed him down, and the current and wind carried the raft away faster than he could swim. As it slipped farther and farther from reach, Louis gave up. He looked back at Phil and Mac, sharing the recognition that their chance was lost. Then he saw a long cord trailing off the raft, snaking not 2 feet from his face. He snatched the cord, reeled the raft to him, and climbed aboard. A second raft was sliding away. Louis pulled out his raft's oars, rowed as hard as he could, and just managed to catch the cord and pull the raft to him. He fed the cords through grommets in the rafts and tied them together. He rowed to Phil and Mac. Realizing that the jagged hunk that he was clinging to might perforate the rafts, Phil pushed it away. Louis pulled Phil aboard, and Mac climbed up under his own power. Both men, like Louis, were filmy with fuel and oil. With all three of them in one raft, it was cramped. The raft was only about 6 feet long and a little more than 2 feet wide. There were two gashes on the left side of Phil's forehead, by the hairline. Blood was spurting from the wounds and mixed with seawater sloshing in the bottom of the raft. Remembering what he had learned in Boy Scouts and his Honolulu first aid course, Louis ran his fingers down Phil's throat until he felt a pulse, the carotid artery. He showed Mac the spot and told him to press down. He pulled off his muslin top shirt and t-shirt and pulled Phil's shirts off as well. He asked Mac to do the same. Setting aside the top shirts, Louis dipped Phil's t-shirt in the water, folded it into a compress, and pressed it to the wounds. He took the other t-shirts and tied them tightly around Phil's head, then slid Phil into the second raft. Phil's mind was woozy. He knew that he'd crashed, that someone had pulled him from the water, that he was in a raft, and that Louis was with him. He felt frightened, though not panicked. As the pilot, he was officially in command, but he grasped his situation well enough to know that he was in no condition to make decisions. He could see that Louis had a nasty cut on his finger near his USC ring, but was otherwise unhurt and lucid. He asked Louis to take command, and Louis agreed. "I'm glad it was you, Samp," Phil said softly. Then he fell quiet. From somewhere nearby, there was a small sound, a moan trailing off into a gargle, a mouth trying to form a word, a throat filling with water. Then silence. Louis grabbed an oar and circled around as rapidly as he could, searching for the drowning man. Maybe it was Kuppernell, who hadn't been seen since he was deep underwater. They would never know. Whoever had made the sound had slipped under. He didn't come up again. With Phil relatively stable, Louis turned his attention to the rafts. Made of two layers of canvas coated in rubber and divided into two air pockets bisected by a bulkhead, each was in good condition. The critical question regarded provisions. The provisions box, which Mac had been holding as the plane went down, was gone, either ripped from his hands during the crash or lost in his escape from the wreckage. In their pockets, the men had only wallets and a few coins. Their watches were still on their wrists, but the hands had stopped when the plane had hit the water. Probably for the first time since Phil had arrived in Oahu, Cece's lucky bracelet wasn't on his wrist, and the silver dollar he'd been keeping for his reunion with her wasn't in his pocket. Maybe in the hurry to dress for the flight he had forgotten them, or maybe they'd been lost in the crash. Pockets in the rafts contained some survival provisions. Whatever was in them was all that they'd have. Louis untied the pocket flaps and looked inside. He found several thick chocolate bars, probably the Hershey Company's military-issue Ration D bars, divided into segments and packaged in wax-dipped containers to resist gas attack. Designed to be unpalatably bitter, so soldiers would eat them only in dire circumstances, they were formulated to be highly caloric and melt-resistant. The package instructions said that each man was to be given two segments a day, one in the morning, one in the evening, to be held on the tongue and allowed to dissolve over 30 minutes. With the chocolate, Louis found several half-pint tins of water, a brass mirror, a flare gun, sea dye, a set of fish hooks, a spool of fishing line, and two air pumps in canvas cases. There was also a set of pliers with a screwdriver built into the handle. Louis pondered it for a long while, trying to come up with a reason why someone would need a screwdriver or pliers on a raft. Each raft also had a patch kit to be used if the raft leaked. That was all there was. The provisions were grossly inadequate. 1 year later, each B-24 raft would be equipped with a sun tarpaulin for shade, blue on one side, yellow on the other. For camouflage in enemy waters, the tarpaulin could be spread blue side up. For signaling, the yellow side could be waved. Each standard 1944 raft would also be equipped with a bailing bucket, a mast and sail, a sea anchor, sun ointment, a first aid kit, puncture plugs, a flashlight, fishing tackle, a jackknife, scissors, a whistle, a compass, and religious pamphlets. None of these items, not even a knife, was in Green Hornet's rafts. The rafts also had no Gibson girl, a radio transmitter that could send signals over some 200 miles. Newer planes had been carrying them for nearly a year, and in 2 months all planes would be equipped, but Green Hornet hadn't been furnished with one. And they had no navigation instruments. It had been Mitchell's job to strap them on his body, but if he had done so, the instruments had gone to the bottom with him. Most worrisome was the water situation. A few half pints wouldn't last them long. The men were surrounded by water, but they couldn't drink it. The salt content in seawater is so high that it is considered a poison. When a person drinks seawater, the kidneys must generate urine to flush the salt away, but to do so, they need more water than is contained in the seawater itself, so the body pulls water from its cells. Bereft of water, the cells begin to fail. Paradoxically, a drink of seawater causes potentially fatal dehydration. Adrift near the equator with little water and no shelter, Phil, Louis, and Mac would soon be in dire trouble. The rafts hadn't been equipped with water desalinizing or distilling materials, nor did they have containers in which to catch rain. 5 months earlier, General Hap Arnold had ordered that all life rafts be equipped with the Delano Sunstill, a device that could generate small amounts of drinking water indefinitely. Delivery had been delayed. From the moment that he had come out of the water, Mac hadn't said a word. He had somehow escaped the crash without injury. He had done everything that Louis had asked of him, but his face had never lost its glazed, startled expression. Louis was bent over the raft when Mac suddenly began wailing. "We're going to die." Louis reassured him that the squadron would come for them, that they were likely to be found that night, at the latest the next day. Mac continued to shout. Louis, exasperated, threatened to report Mac when they returned. It had no effect. At his wit's end, Louis whacked Mac across the cheek with the back of his hand. Mac thumped back and fell silent. Louis came up with ground rules. Each man would eat one square of chocolate in the morning, one in the evening. Louis allotted one water tin per man, with each man allowed 2 to 3 sips a day. Eating and drinking at this rate, they could stretch their supplies for a few days. With inventory taken and rules established, there was nothing to do but wait. Louis made a deliberate effort to avoid thinking about the men who had died, and had to push away the memory of the gurgling voice in the water. Considering the crash, he was amazed that 3 men had survived. All 3 had been on the plane's right side. The fact that the plane had struck on its left had probably saved them. What mystified Louis was his escape from the wreckage. If he had passed out from the pressure, and the plane had continued to sink, and the pressure to build, why had he woken again? And how had he been loosed from the wires while unconscious? The men watched the sky. Louis kept his hand on Phil's head, stanching the bleeding. The last trace of Green Hornet, the shimmer of gas, hydraulic fluid, and oil that had wreathed the rafts since the crash, faded away. In its place, rising from below, came dark blue shapes, gliding in lithe arcs. A neat, sharp form, flat and shining, cut the surface and began tracing circles around the rafts. Another one joined it. The sharks had found them. Fluttering close to their sides were pilot fish, striped black and white. The sharks, which Louis thought were of the mako and reef species, were so close that the men would only have to extend their hands to touch them. The smallest were about 6 feet long. Some were double that size, twice the length of the rafts. They bent around the rafts, testing the fabric, dragging their fins along them, but not trying to get at the men on top. They seemed to be waiting for the men to come to them. The sun sank, and it became sharply cold. The men used their hands to bail a few inches of water into each raft. Once their bodies warmed the water, they felt less chilled. Though exhausted, they fought the urge to sleep, afraid that a ship or submarine would pass and they'd miss it. Phil's lower body under the water was warm enough, but his upper body was so cold that he shook. It was absolutely dark and absolutely silent, save for the chattering of Phil's teeth. The ocean was a flat calm. A rough, rasping tremor ran through the men. The sharks were rubbing their backs along the raft bottoms. Louis's arm was still draped over the side of his raft, his hand resting on Phil's forehead. Under Louis's hand, Phil drifted to sleep, attended by the sensation of sharks scraping down the length of his back. In the next raft, Louis too fell asleep. Mac was alone in his wakefulness, his mind spinning with fear. Grasping at an addled resolution, he began to stir. Chapter 13. Missing at Sea. Daisy May touched down on Palmyra late that afternoon. The crew had searched for Korpening's plane all day, but had seen no trace of it. Daisy had dinner, then went to the base theater. He was watching the film when someone told him to report to the base commander immediately. When he got there, he was told that Green Hornet had never come in. "Holy smoke," he said. He knew that there were 2 possibilities. One was that Philip's crew had turned back to Hawaii. The other was that they were, as Deasy phrased it, in the drink. Someone went to check with Hawaii. Knowing that if Green Hornet was indeed down, they'd still have to wait until morning to search, Deasy went to bed. At around midnight, a sailor woke Deasy's radio man, Herman Scarce, and told him that Phil's plane was missing. The Navy wanted to check Scarce's radio log to see when the last contact with the plane was. Scarce asked the sailor to wake Deasy, and he, Deasy, and Navy officials reviewed the log at the base office. It yielded little information. At 4:30 a.m., Green Hornet was declared missing. 2 planes were now down, Korpening's and Phillips's, taking 21 men with them. The Navy assumed command of the rescue effort. Once the sun was up, Daisy May would be sent out, along with at least 2 Navy flying boats and at least 1 other AAF plane. Because Daisy May and Green Hornet had flown side by side early in the journey, the searchers knew that Green Hornet had not crashed during the first 200 miles of the trip. It had apparently gone down somewhere between the point at which Daisy May had left it and Palmyra, a stretch of 800 miles. The trick was figuring out the direction in which any survivors would be drifting. The ocean around Palmyra was a whirl of currents, lying at the meeting point of the westward-carrying North Equatorial Current and the eastward-carrying Equatorial Countercurrent. A few miles of difference in latitude could mean a 180-degree difference in current direction, and no one knew where the plane had hit. The search area would have to be enormous. Each crew was given search coordinates. From Palmyra, Daisy May would fly north. From Oahu, several planes would fly south. Not long after sunup, the planes took off. Everyone knew that the odds of finding the crew were very long, but, said Scarce, we kept hoping, hoping, hoping. Louis woke with the sun. Mac was beside him, lying back. Phil lay in his raft, his mind still fumbling. Louis sat up and ran his eyes over the sky and ocean in search of rescuers. Only the sharks stirred. Louis decided to divvy up breakfast, a single square of chocolate. He untied the raft pocket and looked in. All of the chocolate was gone. He looked around the rafts. No chocolate, no wrappers. His gaze paused on Mac. The sergeant looked back at him with wide, guilty eyes. The realization that Mac had eaten all of the chocolate rolled hard over Louis. In the brief time that Louis had known Mac, the tail gunner had struck him as a decent, friendly guy, although a bit of a reveler, confident to the point of flippancy. The crash had undone him. Louis knew that they couldn't survive for long without food, but he quelled the thought. A rescue search was surely underway. They'd be on Palmyra later today, maybe tomorrow, and the loss of the chocolate wouldn't matter. Curbing his irritation, Louis told Mac that he was disappointed in him. Understanding that Mac had acted in panic, he reassured him that they'd soon be rescued. Mac said nothing. The chill of the night gave way to a sweltering day. Louis watched the sky. Phil, weak from blood loss, slept. Mac, a shade short of being a redhead, burned in the sun. He remained in a dreamy, distant place. All three men were hungry, but they could do nothing about it. The fish hooks and line were useless. There was no bait. As the men lay in silence, a purring sound began drifting gently between their thoughts. Then all three realized that they were hearing a plane. Searching the sky, they saw a B-25 high up and well to the east. Flying much too high to be a search plane, it was probably on its way to Palmyra. Louis lunged for the raft pocket, retrieved the flare gun, and loaded a flare cartridge. He couldn't stand in the soft-bottomed raft, so he tipped up onto his knees and raised the gun. He squeezed the trigger. The gun bucked in his hand, and the flare, roaring red, streaked up. As it shot overhead, Louis dug out a dye pack and shook it hurriedly into the water, and a pool of vivid greenish-yellow bloomed over the ocean. With the flare arcing over them, Louis, Phil, and Mac watched the bomber willing the men aboard to see them. Slowly, the flare sputtered out. The bomber kept going, and then it was gone. The circle of color around the rafts faded away. The sighting left the castaways with one important piece of information. They had known that they were drifting, but without points of reference, they hadn't known in which direction or how fast. Since planes on the north-south passage from Hawaii followed a flight lane that ran close to Green Hornet's crash site, the appearance of a B-25 far to the east almost certainly meant that the rafts were drifting west, away from the view of friendly planes. Their chances of rescue were already dimming. That evening, the search planes turned back for their bases. No one had seen anything. They would be back in the air at first light. Over the rafts, the daylight died. The men took sips of water, bailed seawater around themselves, and lay down. The sharks came to the rafts again to rub their backs on the undersides. Phil slept for most of the next day. Louis sipped water and thought about food. Mac continued to hunker down, speaking little. For another day, rescue did not come. It was sometime early the next morning, May 30th, when Louis, Mac, and Phil heard a broad, deep rumble of B-24 engines, the sound of home. Then, there it was, low and right overhead, a blunt-faced whale of a plane heading southeast, plowing through the clouds, disappearing and reappearing. It was a search plane. It was so near the rafts that Louis thought he recognized the insignia of their squadron, the 42nd, on the plane's tail. Louis grabbed the flare gun, loaded it, and fired. The flare shot straight at the bomber. For a moment, the men thought that it would hit the plane, but the flare missed, passing alongside the plane, making a fountain of red that looked huge from the raft. Louis reloaded and fired again. The plane turned sharply right. Louis fired two more flares, past the tail. The plane was Daisy May. Its crewmen were straining their eyes at the ocean, passing a pair of binoculars between them. Searching was difficult that day, with loaves of clouds closing and parting, offering the men only brief glimpses of the sea. Everyone felt a particular urgency. The missing men were their squadron mates and friends. "If we ever looked for something on a mission," remembered Scarce, "that day we were looking." The flares spent themselves, and Daisy May flew on. No one aboard saw anything. The plane's pivot had only been a routine turn. Louis, Phil, and Mac watched Daisy May's twin tails grow smaller in the distance, then disappear. For a moment, Louis felt furious with the airmen who had passed so close to them, yet had not seen them, but his anger soon cooled. From his days searching for missing planes, he knew how hard it was to see a raft, especially among clouds. For all he knew, he too had overlooked raft-bound men below him. But what had probably been their best chance of rescue had been lost. With every hour, they were drifting farther west, away from the flight lanes. If they weren't found, the only way they could survive would be to get to land. To their west, they knew, there wasn't a single island for some 2,000 miles. If, by some miracle, they floated that far and were still alive, they might reach the Marshall Islands. If they veered a little south, they might reach the Gilberts. If they were lucky enough to drift to those islands, rather than passing by and out again into the open Pacific, they'd have another problem. Both sets of islands belonged to the Japanese. Watching Daisy May fly away, Louis had a sinking feeling. As the castaways watched their would-be rescuers disappear over the horizon, not far away, George Smitty Smith, who had sat up the night before the crash talking to Phil about Cece, was piloting his B-24 over the ocean, searching for any sign of the lost men. About 50 miles short of Barber's Point, a base on the leeward side of Oahu, his crew spotted something. Spiraling in for a closer look, Smitty saw a muddle of yellow rectangular boxes jostling on the surface. Large fish were circling them. The boxes had not come from Green Hornet. They were too close to Oahu to have traveled that far, especially as the currents wouldn't have carried them in that direction. But Korpening's plane had probably gone down somewhere along the north-south flight lane, the lane over which Smitty was searching. The boxes may well have been the last remains of Korpening's plane and the men aboard it. The boxes weren't the only sighting that Smitty had that day. In the same region where Green Hornet had crashed, he spotted a shock-yellow object bobbing in the water. He swung his bomber down toward it. It appeared to be a provisions box, like the ones carried on B-24s, but he wasn't sure. Smitty flew loops around the box for 15 minutes. There was nothing anywhere near it. No debris, no rafts, no men. Smitty probably believed that he was looking at a piece of Phil's plane, and if he did, he was probably right. He flew back to Oahu, thinking of his friend Cece and all the pain she would feel when she learned that her fiancé was missing. On Oahu, the men of the 42nd Squadron were losing hope. Kuppernell, Phillips, Zamperini, the Olympic miler, and Mitchell lost on their way to Palmyra, a ground crewman wrote in his diary. "I find it hard to get used to such a thing. Just the other day I drove them all to Kahuku and around, kidded around with them. But now they're probably dead. The other pilots act as though nothing has happened and speak of sending the other fellow's clothes home as though it were an everyday occurrence. That's the way it has to be played because that's the way it is. It's an everyday occurrence." The castaways' bodies were declining. Other than Mac's feast on the chocolate bars, none of them had eaten since their early morning breakfast before their last flight. They were intensely thirsty and hungry. After the B-24 sighting, they spent another frigid night, then a long fourth day. There were no planes, no ships, no submarines. Each man drank the last drops of his water. Sometime on the fifth day, Max snapped. After having said almost nothing for days, he suddenly began screaming that they were going to die. Wild-eyed and raving, he couldn't stop shouting. Louis slapped him across the face. Max abruptly went silent and lay down, appearing strangely contented. Maybe he was comforted by Louis's assertion of control. protected thereby from the awful possibilities that his imagination hung before him. Mac had good reason to lose faith. Their water was gone. After the B-24 had passed over, no more planes had come, and the current was carrying them far from the paths trafficked by friendly aircraft. If the search for them hadn't been called off, the men knew it soon would be. That night, before he tried to sleep, Louis prayed. He had prayed only once before in his life, in childhood, when his mother was sick, and he had been filled with a rushing fear that he would lose her. That night on the raft, in words composed in his head, never passing his lips, he pleaded for help. As the lost men drifted farther and farther out of reach, their last letters reached their families and friends, who did not yet know that they were missing. It was apparently military policy to wait for initial searches to be conducted before informing loved ones. On the day after the crash, Phil's final letter to his father arrived in Virginia. Reverend Phillips, who called his son by his middle name, Alan, had joined the army and was now Chaplain Phillips at Camp Pickett. The last news of Alan had reached him weeks earlier in newspaper stories about Superman's saga over Nauru. Chaplain Phillips had carried clippings about the raid to the offices of a local newspaper, which had run a story on Alan's heroism. As proud as he was, Chaplain Phillips was also frightened. "I sure hope that is the closest call he ever has," he wrote to his daughter. It was probably this fear that had led Chaplain Phillips to write to Alan to ask about the fate of the raft-bound men his crew had found encircled by sharks that spring. In his last letter to his father, Alan was reassuring, "The men are all safe." As for himself, Alan wrote, "I'm still in the same place I have been. I'll write again soon. So long for now, Al." On the weekend after the crash, Pete, Virginia, and Louise Zamperini made an impromptu visit to the home of Cuppernell's parents, who lived in Long Beach. It was a merry meeting, and they all talked of their boys. After the visit, Pete wrote to Louis, asking him to tell Cuppernell that his parents were doing great. Before sealing the envelope, he tucked in a photo of himself smiling. On the back, he had scribbled an inscription, "Don't let him clip your wings." In Saranac, California, Peyton Jordan opened the letter that Louis had tossed out the window of Green Hornet as the plane taxied for its last takeoff. "Dear Peyton and Marge," it read, "I am still alive and kicking around. Why, I don't know." That little turkey'd better take care of himself, Jordan thought. Phil's last letter to Cece reached her in Princeton, Indiana, where she was finishing her first year as a high school teacher. In his letter, Phil had written of the moon over Hawaii and how it reminded him of the last time he was with her. "I never will forget that time I spent there with you. There are a lot of things which I'll never forget while I was with you, sweet. I'm waiting for the day when we can begin doing things together again as we used to do." He had closed his letter, as he had so many others, "I love you, I love you, I love you." No more messages would come from the lost men. Pete's letter to Louis made its way to the postmaster in San Francisco, where the 11th Bomb Group's mail was sorted. Someone wrote, "Missing at sea" on the outside, and dropped it back in the mail to Pete. A week had passed since Green Hornet had vanished. Intensive searching had yielded nothing. Every man on Phil's crew was officially declared missing, and in Washington, the process of informing family members was set in motion. The men from Daisy May were told to return the plane from Palmyra to Oahu. The search had been abandoned. The crew was dejected. They wanted to go on looking. As they flew back to Oahu, they talked of the lost men. At Kualoa, a second lieutenant named Jack Cray walked into the cottage to perform the grim duty of cataloging the men's things and sending them to their families. Louis's room was mostly as it had been when Louis had walked out that Thursday morning. Clothes, a footlocker, a diary that ended with a few words about a rescue mission, a pin-up of actress Esther Williams on the wall. The note that Louis had left on the locker was gone, as was the liquor. Among Louis's things, Cray found photographs that Louis had taken inside his plane. In some of them, Louis had forgotten to aim the camera away from the Norden bomb site, so Cray had to confiscate those. The rest of Louis's belongings were packed into his footlocker and ready to be sent to Torrance. On the evening of Friday, June 4, 1943, Phil's mother, Kelsey, was in Princeton, Indiana. In the absence of her husband and son, she had sold the family house in Terre Haute and moved to Princeton to be closer to her daughter, Martha, and future daughter-in-law, Cece, with whom she had become dear friends. That evening, when Kelsey was visiting Martha, someone brought her a telegram. I regret to inform you that the Commanding General Pacific Area reports your son, First Lieutenant Russell A. Phillips, missing since May 27. If further details or other information of his status are received, you will be promptly notified. The telegram reached the Zamperinis that same evening. Louise called Sylvia, who had recently married a firefighter, Harvey Flammer, and now lived in a nearby suburb with her husband. Upon hearing that her brother was missing, Sylvia became hysterical, sobbing so loudly that her neighbor ran to her. When the neighbor asked her what was wrong, Sylvia was crying too hard to speak. Eventually, she pulled herself together enough to call Harvey at the fire station. She was frantic and confused and didn't know what to do. Harvey told her to go to her mother. Sylvia put the phone down and ran straight out the door. Sylvia sobbed for the entire 45-minute drive. Weeks before, just after the Nauru raid, she had picked up her morning paper and seen on the front page a photograph of Louis, looking haunted, staring through a gaping hole in the side of Superman. The image had horrified her. Now, as she absorbed the news that Louis was missing, she couldn't stop seeing that image. When she pulled up at her parents' house, she had to compose herself before she walked in. Her father was calm but quiet. Her mother was consumed in anguish. Sylvia, who, like the rest of the family, assumed that Louis had gone down in the ocean, told her mother not to worry. "With all those islands," Sylvia said, "he's teaching someone hula." Pete arrived from San Diego. "If he has a toothbrush and a pocket knife and he hits land," he told his mother, "he'll make it." Perhaps that day, perhaps later, Louise found the tiny snapshot that had been taken on the afternoon Louis had left, when he had stood beside her on the front steps, his arm around her waist. On the back of the photograph, Louise wrote, "Louis reported missing, May 27, 1943. The news of Louis' disappearance headlined California newspapers and led radio broadcasts on June 5th. The Los Angeles Evening Herald and Express ran a feature on the life of Zamp, which looked an awful lot like an obituary. Peyton Jordan, now a Navy officer, was driving to his base when he heard the news on the radio. Jordan gasped. He drove into the base feeling numb, and for a while did nothing at all. Then he started speaking to his fellow officers. Jordan's job was to train cadets in survival techniques, and he and the others considered the possibilities that might face Louis. All of the officers agreed that if Louis had the right training, he might survive. Pete called Jordan, and they talked about Louis. As Pete spoke of his hope that Louis would be found, Jordan could hear his voice wavering. Jordan thought about calling Louis's parents, but he couldn't bring himself to do it. He had no idea what to say. That evening, he drove home and told his wife, Marge, who had known Louis well at USC. They moved through their routines in a quiet fog, then went to bed and lay awake in silence. In Torrance, Anthony Zamperini remained stoic. Louise cried and prayed. From the stress, open sores broke out all over her hands. Sylvia thought her hands looked like raw hamburger. Somewhere in those jagged days, a fierce conviction came over Louise. She was absolutely certain that her son was alive. On Samoa, Stanley Pillsbury and Clarence Douglas were still in the hospital, trying to recover from the wounds incurred over Nauru. Douglas's shoulder was far from healed, and to Pillsbury he seemed emotionally gutted. Pillsbury was in considerable pain. The doctors had been unable to remove all the shrapnel from his leg, and he could feel every shard burning. He wasn't close to being able to walk. In his dreams, planes dove at him endlessly. Pillsbury was in his bed when Douglas came in, his face radiating shock. "The crew went down," he said. Pillsbury could barely speak. His first emotion was overwhelming guilt. "If I had only been there," he said later, "I could have saved it." Douglas and Pillsbury said little more to each other. They parted, each man swimming in grief. Douglas would soon be granted transfer back to the States. Pillsbury would linger on his cot in Samoa, hoping that he would one day walk again. On Oahu, Louis's friends gathered in a barracks. In the corner of one of the rooms, they hung a small flag in memory of Zamp. It would hang there as Louis, Phil, and Mac drifted west, and the Allies, the 11th Bomb Group's 42nd Squadron among them, carried the war across the Pacific and into the throat of Japan. Chapter 14. Thirst. Phil felt as if he were on fire. The equatorial sun lay upon the men, scalding their skin. Their upper lips burned and cracked, ballooning so dramatically that they obstructed their nostrils, while their lower lips bulged against their chins. Their bodies were slashed with open cracks that formed under the corrosive onslaught of sun, salt, wind, and fuel residue. Whitecaps slapped into the fissures, a sensation that Louis compared to having alcohol poured onto a wound. Sunlight glared off the ocean, sending barbs of white light into the men's pupils and leaving their heads pounding. The men's feet were cratered with quarter-sized salt sores. The rafts baked along with their occupants, emitting a bitter smell. The water cans were empty. Desperately thirsty and overheated, the men could do no more than use their hands to bail seawater over themselves. The coolness of the ocean beckoned and couldn't be answered, for the sharks circled. One shark, 6 or 8 feet long, stalked the rafts without rest day and night. The men became especially wary of him, and when he ventured too close, one of them would jab him with an oar. On the third day without water, a smudge appeared on the horizon. It grew, darkened, billowed over the rafts, and lidded the sun. Down came the rain. The men threw back their heads, spilled their bodies back, spread their arms, and opened their mouths. The rain fell on their chests, lips, faces, tongues. It soothed their skin, washed the salt and sweat and fuel from their pores, slid down their throats, fed their bodies. It was a sensory explosion. They knew it wouldn't last. They had to find a way to save the water. The narrow water tins, open to the downpour, caught virtually nothing. Louis, keeping his head tipped up and his mouth open, felt around the raft for something better. He dug into the raft pockets and pulled out one of the air pumps. It was sheathed in a canvas case about 14 inches long, stitched down one side. He tore the seam open, spread the fabric to form a triangular bowl, and watched happily as the rain pooled on the fabric. He had collected some 2 pints of water when a whitecap cracked into the raft, crested over, and slopped into the canvas, spoiling the water. Not only had the most productive part of the storm been wasted, but the canvas had to be rinsed in the rain before Louis could resume capturing water. Even when that was done, there was no way to avoid the next whitecap, because Louis couldn't see them coming. Louis tried a new technique. Instead of allowing large pools of water to gather, he began continuously sucking the captured water into his mouth, then spitting it in the cans. Once the cans were full, he kept harvesting the rain, giving one man a drink every 30 seconds or so. They tore open the second pump case to form another rain catcher. When the sun emerged, they found that the canvas cases also made excellent hats. They began rotations with them, 2 men in, 1 man out. The men were ravenous. It was now clear that Mac's binge on the chocolate, which had seemed only moderately worrisome at the time, was a catastrophe. Louis resented Mac, and Mac seemed to know it. Though Mac never spoke of it, Louis sensed that he was consumed with guilt over what he had done. As hunger bleated inside them, the men experienced a classic symptom of starvation, the inability to direct their thoughts away from food. They stared into the ocean, undulating with edible creatures, but without bait, they couldn't catch even a minnow. Occasionally, a bird passed, always out of reach. The men studied their shoes and wondered if they could eat the leather. They decided that they couldn't. Days passed. Each evening, the roasting heat gave way to cold. Sleep was elusive. Phil, alone in his raft and lacking the heat of another man to warm the water around him, suffered particularly badly. He shook through each night, too cold to sleep. In the daytime, exhaustion, heat, and the lolling of the raft made them all drowsy. They slept through much of each day and spent the rest lying back, saving their precious evaporating energy. It occurred to Phil that from the point of view of the birds, their still forms, obscured by canvas hoods, must have looked like lifeless debris. He was right. One day, 9 or 10 days into their odyssey, Louis felt something alight on his hood and saw its shadow fall before him. It was an albatross. With Louis's head hidden, the bird hadn't recognized that he was landing on a man. Slowly, slowly, Louis raised his hand toward the bird his motion so gradual that it was little more noticeable than the turning of a minute hand on a clock. The bird rested calmly. In time, Louis's hand was beside the bird, his fingers open. All at once, Louis snapped his hand shut, clamping down on the bird's legs. The bird pecked frantically, slashing his knuckles. Louis grabbed its head and broke its neck. Louis used the pliers to tear the bird open. A gust of fetid odor rose from the body, and all three men recoiled. Louis handed a bit of meat to Phil and Mac and took one for himself. The stench hung before them, spurring waves of nausea. Gagging, they couldn't get the meat into their mouths. Eventually, they gave up. Though they couldn't eat the bird, they finally had bait. Louis took out the fishing gear, tied a small hook to a line, baited it, and fed it into the water. In a moment, a shark cruised by, bit down on the hook, and severed the line, taking the bait, the hook, and a foot or two of line with him. Louis tried another hook, and again, a shark took it. A third try produced the same result. Finally, the sharks let a hook hang unmolested. Louis felt a tug and pulled up the line. On its end hung a slender pilot fish, about 10 inches long. As Louis pulled it apart, everyone felt apprehensive. None of them had eaten raw fish before. They each put a bit of meat into their mouths. It was flavorless. They ate it down to the bones. It was the first food to cross their lips in more than a week. Between three men, a small fish didn't go far, but the protein gave them a push of energy. Louis had demonstrated that if they were persistent and resourceful, they could catch food, and both he and Phil felt inspired. Only Mac remained unchanged. Phil felt uneasy about the albatross. Like many schoolboys of his era, he had read Samuel Taylor Coleridge's Rime of the Ancient Mariner. In the poem, a sailor kills a friendly albatross that, it is said, had made the winds blow. In consequence, the sailor and his crew are stranded in infernal, windless waters, tormented by thirst and monstrous creatures. The crewmen all die, and the sailor is left in a hellish limbo, the albatross hung about his neck, his eyes closed against the accusing stares of his dead crewmen. Louis wasn't superstitious, but he'd grown fond of albatrosses on that Christmas he'd spent watching them crash land on Midway. He felt sorry for the bird. Phil reminded Louis that killing an albatross was said to bring bad luck. After a plane crash, Louis replied, what more bad luck could they have? Several more days passed. Louis caught nothing, and his hook supply dwindled. No more birds landed on the raft. Periodically, rain replenished the water tins, but only part way. The men floated in a sensory vacuum. When the weather was calm, the ocean was silent. There was nothing to touch but water, skin, hair, and canvas. Other than the charred smell of the raft, there were no odors. There was nothing to look at but sea and sky. At some point, Louis stuck his finger in his ear and felt wax there. He smelled his finger, and by virtue of being new, the scent of the wax was curiously refreshing. He developed a habit of twisting his finger in his ear and sniffing it. Phil began doing it too. When Louis slept, he dreamed of being on land, trying to sleep, but there was never a place to rest safely. Only rocks, sucking mud, beds of cactus. He would be on perilous cliffs or unstable boulders, and the ground would heave and shift under his weight. Phil was having the same dreams. As time passed, Phil began thinking about an article written by the World War I ace pilot Eddie Rickenbacker that he had read in Life magazine that winter. The previous October, a B-17 carrying Rickenbacker and a crew over the Pacific had become lost and run out of fuel. The pilot had ditched the plane, and it had floated long enough for the men to get into rafts. The men had drifted for weeks, surviving on stores in the rafts, rainwater, fish, and bird meat. One man had died, and the rest had hallucinated, babbling at invisible companions, singing bizarre songs, arguing about where to pull over the imaginary car in which they were riding. One lieutenant had been visited by a specter who had tried to lure him to the bottom of the ocean. Finally, the rafts had split up, and one had reached an island. Natives had radioed to Funafuti, and the other men had been rescued. It seemed that Rickenbacker's crew had stretched the capacity for human survival as far as it would go. Rickenbacker had written that he had drifted for 21 days, He had actually drifted for 24, and Phil, Louis, and Mac believed that this was a survival record. In fact, the record for inflated raft survival appears to have been set in 1942, when three Navy plane crash victims survived for 34 days on the Pacific before reaching an island where they were sheltered by natives. At first, Phil gave no thought to counting days, but when time stretched on, he began paying attention to how long they'd been out there. He had no trouble counting days without confusion. Because they were on the raft for only part of the day they crashed, Phil and Louis counted the following day as day one. With each new day, Phil told himself that surely they'd be picked up before reaching Rickenbacker's mark. When he considered what they'd do if they passed that mark, he had no answer. Rickenbacker's story, familiar to Louis also, was important for another reason. Exposure, dehydration, stress, and hunger had quickly driven many of Rickenbacker's party insane, a common fate for raft-bound men. Louis was more concerned about sanity than he was about sustenance. He kept thinking of a college physiology class he had taken, in which the instructor had taught them to think of the mind as a muscle that would atrophy if left idle. Louis was determined that no matter what happened to their bodies, their minds would stay under their control. Within a few days of the crash, Louis began peppering the other two with questions on every conceivable subject. Phil took up the challenge, and soon he and Louis turned the raft into a non-stop quiz show. They shared their histories, from first memories onward, recounted in minute detail. Louis told of his days at USC. Phil spoke of Indiana. They recalled the best dates they'd ever had. They told and retold stories of practical jokes that they played on each other. Every answer was followed by a question. Phil sang church hymns. Louis taught the other two the lyrics to White Christmas. They sang it over the ocean, a holiday song in June, heard only by circling sharks. Every conversation meandered back to food. Louis had often boasted to Phil about his mother's cooking, and at some point, Phil asked Louis to describe how she made a meal. Louis began describing a dish, and all three men found it satisfying. So Louis kept going, telling them about each dish in the greatest possible detail. Soon, Louise's kitchen floated there with them. Sauces simmered, spices were pinched and scattered, butter melted on tongues. So began a thrice-daily ritual on the raft, with pumpkin pie and spaghetti being the favorite subjects. The men came to know Louise's recipe so well that if Louis skipped a step or forgot an ingredient, Phil, and sometimes Mac, would quickly correct him and make him start over. When the imaginary meal was prepared, the men would devour every crumb, describing each mouthful. They conjured up the scene in such vivid detail that somehow their stomachs were fooled by it, if only briefly. Once the food was eaten and the past exhausted, they moved to the future. Louis laid plans to buy the Torrance train depot and turn it into a restaurant. Phil fantasized about getting back to Indiana, maybe to teach school. He couldn't wait to see the Indy 500 again. The race had been suspended because of the war, but Phil revived it in his mind, spreading a blanket on the infield grass, heaping it with food, and watching the cars blur past, and he thought about Cece. It hadn't occurred to him to tuck her picture in his wallet before he left the cottage, but in his mind, she never left him. For Louis and Phil, the conversations were healing, pulling them out of their suffering and setting the future before them as a concrete thing. As they imagined themselves back in the world again, they willed a happy ending onto their ordeal and made it their expectation. With these talks, they created something to live for. In all of these bull sessions, not once did they broach the subject of the crash. Louis wanted to talk about it, but something about Phil stopped him. There were times when Phil seemed lost in troubled thoughts, and Louis guessed that he was reliving the crash, and perhaps holding himself responsible for the deaths of his men. Louis wanted to reassure Phil that he'd done nothing wrong, but he decided that raising the issue would deepen Phil's preoccupation. So he said nothing. As Louis and Phil grilled each other, Mac usually sat in silence. Sometimes he'd ask Louis to describe a recipe, and occasionally he would interject, but getting him to fully participate was rough going. He shared few memories, and though the other two encouraged him, he couldn't imagine a future. To him, it seemed, the world was too far gone. Given the dismal record of raft-bound men, Mac's despair was reasonable. What is remarkable is that the two men who shared Mac's plight didn't share his hopelessness. Though Phil was constantly wondering how long this would go on, it had not yet occurred to him that he might die. The same was true for Louis. Though they both knew that they were in an extremely serious situation, both had the ability to warn fear away from their thoughts, focusing instead on how to survive and reassuring themselves that things would work out. It remains a mystery why these three young men, veterans of the same training and the same crash, differed so radically in their perceptions of their plight. Maybe the difference was biological. Some men may be wired for optimism, others for doubt. As a toddler, Louis had leapt from a train and watched it bear his family away, yet had remained cheerfully unconcerned about his safety, suggesting that he may have been a born optimist. Perhaps the men's histories had given them opposing convictions about their capacity to overcome adversity. Phil and Louis had survived Funafuti and performed uncommonly well over Nauru, and each trusted the other. "If there was one thing left, he'd have given it to me," Phil once said of Louis. Mac had never seen combat, didn't know these officers, and was largely an unknown quantity to himself. All he knew about his ability to cope with this crisis was that on the first night, he had panicked and eaten the only food they had. As time passed and starvation loomed, this act took on greater and greater importance, and it may have fed Mac's sense of futility. For Phil, there was another source of strength, one of which even Louis was unaware. According to his family, in his quiet, private way, Phil was a deeply religious man, carrying a faith instilled in him by his parents. "I had told Al several times before to always do his best as he knew how to do it," Phil's father once wrote, "and when things get beyond his skill and ability, to ask the Lord to step in and help out." Phil never spoke of his faith, but as he sang hymns over the ocean, conjuring up a protective God, perhaps rescue felt closer, despair more distant. From earliest childhood, Louis had regarded every limitation placed on him as a challenge to his wits, his resourcefulness, and his determination to rebel. The result had been a mutinous youth. As maddening as his exploits had been for his parents and his town, Louis' success in carrying them off had given him the conviction that he could think his way around any boundary. Now, as he was cast into extremity, despair and death became the focus of his defiance. The same attributes that had made him the boy terror of Torrance were keeping him alive in the greatest struggle of his life. Though all three men faced the same hardship, their differing perceptions of it appeared to be shaping their fates. Louis and Phil's hope displaced their fear and inspired them to work toward their survival, and each success renewed their physical and emotional vigor. Mac's resignation seemed to paralyze him, and the less he participated in their efforts to survive, the more he slipped. Though he did the least as the days passed, it was he who faded the most. Louis and Phil's optimism and Mac's hopelessness were becoming self-fulfilling. 2 weeks had passed. The men's skin was burned, swollen, and cracked. Mysterious white lines striped their fingernails and toenails, and salt sores were marching up their legs, buttocks, and backs. The rafts were decomposing in the sun and salt water, bleeding vivid yellow dye onto the men's clothing and skin and making everything sticky. The men's bodies slowly winnowed. Each day, Louis noticed incremental differences in his weight and the weight of his raft mates from the day before. The pants looser, the faces narrower. As they passed the fortnight mark, they began to look grotesque. Their flesh had evaporated. Their cheeks, now bearded, had sunken into concavity. Their bodies were digesting themselves. They were reaching a stage of their ordeal that for other castaways had been a gruesome turning point. In 1820, after the whaling ship Essex was sunk by an enraged whale, the lifeboat-bound survivors on the brink of death resorted to cannibalism. Some 60 years later, after 19 days adrift, starving survivors of the sunken yacht Mignonette killed and ate a teenaged crewman. Stories of cannibalism among castaways were so common that the British gave a name to the practice of choosing a victim, dubbing it the custom of the sea. To well-fed men on land, the idea of cannibalism has always inspired revulsion. To many sailors who have stood on the threshold of death, lost in the agony and mind-altering effects of starvation, it has seemed a reasonable, even inescapable solution. For Louis, the idea of consuming a human being was revolting and unthinkable. To eat a human being, even if the person